You're listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental.
How are you feeling after that, Matt?
I feel a lot better than Bob.
Extra Time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
You guys are the experts. You'll probably have to analyze that.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from Brooklyn, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental. Not from the AT&T MLS studios. We thank them for the support. I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer. What's up, guys? Charlie Davies here, Matt Doyle, David Goss, Kevin Payne, longtime U.S. soccer executive, and the brains behind DC United will be here with us in just a little bit. Everybody feeling good on this Monday or whatever day of the week it is here?
Feeling
I have no
great.
Idea. It all blends together.
I mean, there's a Groundhog Day sort of reality to the way we're living right now. But the sun is out in New York, so that improves my mood about fivefold. yeah, hanging in there, man.
Goss?
Yeah, you know, it's not exactly
it's like deep in thought over there.
Yeah, not exactly. Well, I was actually doing a little research because Wiebe prompted us with an early topic that I hadn't done the proper research for and didn't remember my years on. So I was trying to sneak a little bit of that in. But Charlie, like any good teacher, you caught me.
There you go. There you go. Look, it's not even a hard one. It's your first MLS memory because today is April 6th. And of course, that is the anniversary 25 years ago of the first ever MLS game. The Clash and DC United. You're going to be on stream here later with Eric Winalda and Jeff Agus talking through that game, watching that game. People can watch it on YouTube. Of course, ESPN has their slate of programming on this Monday night as we record at about noon. You might catch that if you listen to the pod right when it comes out at 5 p.m. Eastern, or you might not. And if you don't, ESPN Plus now has a cachet of classic games, or will very, very soon, to keep you entertained through these long, uncertain days. The prompt was, what's your first MLS memory, Dave? That should be in your brain. You should be able to pull that out immediately.
Well, I was trying to find the year. So my first memory isn't watching games or going to games. It's playing backyard soccer. And I'm pretty sure Kobe Jones was in one of the versions that I used to play and I used to pick every time. I couldn't remember what year version of backyard soccer that was. Turns out the Wikipedia pages on backyard soccer is not as informative as you'd like and not as, you know, obvious of how to use them. So that would be my first memory. My first game, I think, was in 2004. We talked about that a few weeks ago. I'd say 2003 was when I really got into following the league, watching the league. I'd sneak over to friends' houses on Saturday nights to watch FSC games on Saturday night because my parents wouldn't get the channel until I got a certain level of grades, which took a really long time to get to, and watching games on MSG.
If you don't know, FSC, Fox Soccer Channel. That was my first sort of introduction to. I remember ponying up with my money from the KU bookstore in college and being like, man, I don't know if I can afford this $15 a month, but I'm just going to bite the bullet and do it. My first MLS memory in stadium, and that's where I'll take this one, is 2007 at Arrowhead Stadium. The KC Wizards, led by Eddie Johnson, against the New York Red Bulls. With Juan Pablo Angel and Wolniak up top, and they had Dima Kovalenko, and they had Clint Mathis. And I remember Eddie had scored a hat trick the game before. I went with my dad and my brother, and it was not very packed. Let's just put it that way. But it was hard for Arrowhead to look packed because it was like a 70,000 sea of empty seats. But Eddie got a hat trick, like kind of a vintage Eddie Johnson hat trick. He was actually, with that game, the first player to have back-to-back hat tricks in the league's history, but there was a lot else going on. Clint Mathis elbowed Kerry Zavagnin right in the throat and got chucked out of the game. Yeah. JPA opened the scoring, and I was obsessed with Juan Pablo Angel at this time.
As was my wife, by the way.
Yeah. Via flick from Wolniak. So you got like legend on legend there from different parts of soccer culture. And then Dima Kovalenko had a deflected goal. But I remember my dad and my brother and I sitting there watching it, and I'd played soccer until I was, you know, eighth grade and had to quit to play baseball full time. And my brother was still playing full time. We were kind of like, we'd never been to anything other than a professional indoor game. And it was eye opening. We were like, this was awesome. This is cool. Now, I helped the five goals got scored and the home team won. And it was like a treat for us to go to Kansas City. But yeah, that was my first MLS in-stadium memory. And basically off the back of that, I said to myself, I'm going to start a blog spot and I'm going to cover this team for free. So that was the spark that led me down this long road to video podcasting with you in an empty bedroom on a Monday in the middle of a pandemic. So
yeah, I mean, my first memory of MLS was watching Eric Winalda score that goal in the first game. That's my first memory. But in stadium, it was just before my 10th birthday, New England Revolution versus LA Galaxy. You know, I was such a fan of the game because of the 94 World Cup. So Kobe Jones was like a hero of mine. And to go see him play the hometown New England Revolution, I just wanted to see goals. Because the first game I went to, World Cup, was South Korea-Bolivia, 0-0, no goal scored. So I just wanted to see some goals. It ended up being 2-2. So I had to see four goals. Kobe Jones scored. And I remember having a ball. And I was like, man, if I get an autograph, like I'm going to be the happiest kid in the world. I waited after the game. A ton of players signed it, including Kobe Jones. And I went back in the car and I remember on the whole ride home, I was like, oh, this is my precious.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Do you still have it?
I still do.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, you got it. Like, next show, you got to bring that out. And we got to.
Yeah, it's at my parents' house. So.
Oh, all right.
We'll find a way. There's something about autographs at that age. I remember waiting in the bowels of the Kansas Coliseum for Wichita Wings players to sign like headshots for hours, and thinking that my time could not be used in a better way other than standing in that line with my aunt, just mm-hmm. waiting and waiting and waiting. Doyle, what's your first in-stadium experience, MLS?
It was summer 96. It was after my freshman year of college. A bunch of buddies from college, we all drove up to Foxborough, to the old stadium in Foxborough. Charlie knows. And it was like, that was not a lovely stadium. It was a lot of concrete and a lot of aluminum benches and a lot of 32-ounce beers. And it was – Preki became famous in MLS circles in about 2.5 weeks because he would do everything you could to scour the nascent internet at that point and to hope that there were highlights on SportsCenter. And you could always find a Preki chop. Could always find, like, it became famous that quickly. So Kansas City was coming to Foxborough in like early summer of 96, and we loaded up a car, probably six or eight of us, and we drove up to Foxborough and we did a drinking game, other than the one kid who was the designated driver, and we did a drinking game and we drank every time Preki chopped someone. And it got messy, especially because at some point he scored. And like, I can't vouch for this because memories are funny things, especially when they've been, lubricated. But I swear he chopped. It wasn't Alexi. It was one of the other defenders on the Revs, and like scored it like a classic Preki goal. So that was a finish your drink. That was my first in-stadium experience. And I ended up having many more like that, but right off the bat, like, I want people to understand how incredible Preki was. He was 32 years old. He was an indoor guy, scored like 1,000 goals for Tacoma, I think it was. He had played for Everton in the Premier League. He had this like really bizarre career. He came through that great Red Star Belgrade youth system back in the early 80s, and here he was at 32 in MLS starting a new league, and like he's instantly on the same level as guys like Valderrama and Echeverry, and he's like outplaying Roberto Donadoni head to head. It was wild.
Doyle, I forgot to bring this up a few weeks ago. We were talking about something around when the Metro Stars became the Red Bulls. Mm-hmm. They used to give away a full Snickers bar if they scored after a certain minute when you left the stadium. Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
They used to just leave the boxes at the gates as you left. And that was like the highlight of the game. Someone would score, you'd get like 30 Snickers bars and go home. That was the dream.
No, I don't recall that one. No.
So those are our memories, but I want more from you, Doyle. But first, just a quick promo for people that are waiting to see what's coming. Kevin Payne, longtime U.S. soccer executive. He's going to help us remember what it was like in 1996, but also 91 and 94 and all the years that it took to get this league up and running. He said it was like basically driving an airplane in flight, not knowing how to drive an airplane. So he'll give us some stories. We've got Columbus Crew SC's Mount Rushmore. Why did I say SC? I have no idea. I will never say it again. I'm so sorry. And the San Jose Earthquakes, both of them really, really difficult as I did my research last night. And then we've got Felipe in LA telling Charlie why he's dead wrong about Cienfuegos versus Beckham. But use the hashtag MLSN96. Go share your first MLS memories. Like, I love hearing these. I love learning how people got into the league. MLSN96 is now on Instagram, too, with some sick throwback content. Check that out. Mm-hmm. Go listen to the call-up. Brad Guzan is their guest this week. And tune into the MLS Classics Remix on Wednesday, 4 p.m. Eastern, the first Hell is Real matchup. It's going to be me, Doyle, Andrew Gutman from Cincy, and Columbus's Jonathan Mensah. So that should be really, really fun. Before we get to Kevin Payne, Doyle, I read your column, your Q&A about 96. Just help me and help everybody else understand what it was really like from a fan's perspective, from a young man's perspective. What was going on in this country as far as professional soccer goes, and how does it compare to what we have now?
It's night and day. And a lot of it, I think the biggest way to contextualize it and understand it is from what Charlie said. Charlie was 8 or 9 years old for 94 World Cup, and that hooked him. And it hooked so many other people, but also it was proof of concept that soccer in the United States could work. Because at that point in time, there was still very vivid memories of the old NASL failing. NASL went out of business in 1984. So, you know, there was a very loud and very prominent sort of mainstream sports writer take that professional top flight soccer in the U.S. was never going to be a thing.
Charlie's coming after your boy, Dan Shaughnessy.
Yeah, right. Shaughnessy was one of them for sure.
Is still one of them. Somehow.
Is still, yeah. He still thinks it's not going to work. Okay. So that underpinned everything. But then what happened in 94 was the U.S. showed it, like the U.S. team wasn't just a curiosity. They could go out there and they could beat Colombia. They could go toe to toe with, you know, Romania. They could, and, you know, go toe to toe for 90 minutes with Brazil, and yeah, we lost, but it was a fight. They weren't college kids getting just steamrolled. So Alexi became a star. Kobe Jones became a star. Guys like Balboa, Tab Ramos, Eric Winalda, not stars at that level, because like Miola, yeah, like Kobe and Alexi were the breakouts, but like these other guys, sports fans knew who they were. And then these guys came to MLS and with the idea that on the field they would be pillars of the team because they were, you know, obviously the best players that the U.S. had, or, you know, so the thought was, and then they would be off-field pillars of marketing and business and the way to bring in fans. And then that was interspersed with a certain level of star power. You know, getting Jorge Campos, he was 30 at that point. He was a star for the Mexican national team. Getting Carlos Valderrama, he was 34. He was a little bit over the hill, but not really, because even when he was 24, Pibe didn't run. So they got him, and like they gave him a bunch of athletic players to put around him, and he was like, the great quote is, Valderrama played soccer the way other people play golf. Walk a couple yards, swing, hit the ball, walk another couple yards, swing, hit the, like, so you had like this diversity of approaches, and it was a global league in a lot of ways right off the bat, and it was enjoyable. At the same time, there was always going to be – well, let me put it this way. I lived with existential dread about the league failing until about 2006 or 2007. You know what? I think it was the first Toronto game. When I saw that crowd in 2007, I said, okay, this league – is going to last. I'm not going to have to tell my nephew someday, oh, I remember when there was a top flight league in the U.S. Like, so all of that sort of combined. And as fans, I think a lot of us were like, we're rooting for our team, but we also wanted to do our part. We wanted to show up there and, you know, come up with chance, or really steal a lot of chance, especially from Argentina. like there were a lot of, there were so many great the Spanish-speaking supporter groups back then, and I know there's a lot now as well, and like trying to create that atmosphere, it felt like a cause. It felt like a cause. And so, like, it was so frustrating to a lot of us to see soccer fans in the U.S. not join in and be part of the cause. But here we are now, 24 years later, and we can see what it's become. And it's, I still don't have the right words for it, but I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it.
Let's talk then to one of the architects of those early days in the league, of the growth of the 94 World Cup, of so much more. It's an AT&T call to the field. That man's name is Kevin Payne. He's a longtime soccer executive here in the U.S. You probably remember him as the president of DC United in their glory years. He was with AEG Soccer for a couple years, went back to DC, then was in Toronto, is now U.S. Club Soccer's CEO. Kevin, welcome to Extra Time.
Very well. It's great to see you guys. Charlie, it's great to see you again.
Great to see you as well, KP.
Let's go back, man. Let's reminisce, because today is April 6th, and of course that is the anniversary, 25 years ago now, of the very first MLS game, the clash in DC United, and you were the president and CEO of DC at the time. 96 was when the game was, but when did you start putting things together? What was the task? How did you basically build a team, a league from scratch?
Yeah, so the first meeting that, I was running a company at the time called Soccer USA Partners. We owned all the rights for the U.S. national teams. So all the sponsorship, TV, game promotion, and so forth. We also had the obligation to put all those games on. But that had begun in 1990, and we did that through 1994, through the World Cup. And that was kind of our role in helping ready the nation for the World Cup. We did games all over the country. We did over 100 games in 4 years. And I knew Alan very, I had been at the Federation before that. So the two men that owned that company said to me, "What do you think about the idea of a professional league?" And I said, "I think if it's done right, it will work. And the World Cup is demonstrating that there's an interest in the game." So we met, I think the first meeting we had with Alan was actually before the World Cup. It was in March of 1994 in New York. And we said, we're interested. We would like to be in this. So he kind of checked us off. I think we were the second group to tell him pretty definitively that we were in. I think Lamar was first, Lamar Hunt. And we were either second or third. I think we were second. I think John Kluge and Metro Media stepped up. But that was after the actual games of the World Cup were played. We were pretty much committed before the World Cup. Now, that was a pretty soft commitment, because then we all had to figure out, how many teams do we need to have to start? How much money do we need to have to start? In my case, I had to raise most of the money. The two guys that owned the company, they were willing to put up a certain amount, but I had to raise the majority of, I had to raise about 80% of what we needed. So it was a very long, it was a very short process in a lot of ways. It seemed long at the time. It was a very frantic time. We were doing an unbelievable amount of stuff all at the same time. It was very exciting.
And KP, prior to that, in 1990, you were the director of marketing for the U.S. Soccer Federation. What was the soccer landscape like prior to that 94 World Cup? And how were you able to get sponsors to buy in? Because you raised $35 million from that World Cup in 1994. How were you able to go to sponsors and say, "Hey, I have something special. Give me some money"?
Well, I'll tell you. So I started at the Federation actually as the national administrator. That was the title. I was actually hired to be the executive director, but they didn't have that position, didn't exist. And I was hired I started work about 8 or 9 days before the game in Trinidad. And I remember on the flight back from Trinidad, we went through Kennedy Airport. And I picked up a New York Times. And there was on like page 3 of the sports section, there was about a 4-column-inch story about us qualifying for the World Cup for the first time since 1950. And I was absolutely over the moon. We had made the New York Times. And, you know, so now we kind of, we all took a deep breath and said, well, now what? You know, now what do we do? And so we needed to figure out a way to promote the men's national team. And, you know, obviously the game itself, but certainly our men, our U.S. men were very, very important. And so U.S. Soccer ended up putting together a relationship with this company, Soccer USA Partners. And I was the director of marketing at U.S. Soccer. And then in late 1991, I moved over to become the executive vice president of that company. And we had worked very closely together before that. So, I mean, it was hard, Charlie. It was, I tell a lot of stories about it, but there's one I will never forget till the day I die. I went to see the brand manager of Oscar Mayer hot dogs.
Yeah.
It wasn't Oscar Mayer, it was Armor hot dogs. I flew to Chicago and I, you know, get shown in, and he's got like a cubicle, like a pretty big cubicle, but you know, he's a classic brand manager in a big company. And he's a big beefy guy. And in those days, one of the styles was, particularly in Chicago, guys used to wear their, you know, everybody wore a tie, and they would wear their collars like pretty tight. And they had these collar bars that went under the knot of the tie, but across the collar. And everybody looked like they were strangling to death. And so this guy was probably 260 pounds. He was a big dude. And behind him on a wall is his son's football team, you know, Frank. So I sit down with him, and the very first thing he says to me, and I hadn't set the meeting up. We had a guy that set the meetings up. And the first thing he says to me is, I don't know why I took this meeting, because I absolutely hate soccer. And I thought,
interesting way to start things.
But I actually was able to convince him. They didn't become a sponsor, but I had three meetings with him in all, two subsequent meetings. And the only reason that they didn't become a sponsor is because his budgets got cut. It was a difficult time. And there were some companies that were pretty forward-looking. Sprint was one. We had a meeting with Sprint on a Friday. They had the heads of all the different divisions of the company there. It was a guy named Mike Forte, who's no longer with us, and me. We presented. Actually, at that point, I was still with U.S. Soccer. We presented the U.S. national team at $2.5 million a year times. At that point, it was almost 4 years, plus the World Cup at $7.5 million. And when I got back into my office my office at the time was in Colorado Springs on Monday, at 9:30, my phone rang, and it was a guy named Tom Wegman, who was the CMO of Sprint, and he said, we want a letter of intent. And I said, for what? And he said, for everything. That was a real turning point moment. All of a sudden, we had this really dynamic, large company committing to, you know, about $15 million over three and a half years. So, you know, we had the old faithfuls. AB, Anheuser-Busch was with us. Adidas was with us. But everybody else, we had to convince to do it. American Airlines came in pretty early. But even some of the global sponsors of World Cup, like MasterCard at the time, it took us a year to convince them that they wouldn't be wasting their money in the U.S. It was a challenging time. And you know, I was talking about this with somebody the other day that there was a lot of media, particularly older, you know, sports editors and sports directors on radio stations who actively wanted our sport to fail.
Right.
There was a guy named Frank DeFord who was very well known, who had just become the editor, I guess, editor in chief of a national paper called The National. And he just absolutely hated soccer. I never could understand why, but that was a real challenge for us.
So let's take it forward a little bit, though, to DC United, because you mentioned raising the money, you get the team together, and then you put together one of the best rosters in MLS history, and you go from the first day, or took a few weeks, but from the first few weeks of that first season through to 2000, 2001 as one of the best teams. It always fascinates me because when you learn about this time, you have, you know, this player draft, this allocation, the college draft, players coming signed by the league from Europe, from South America, and then the teams individually. What was the roster building to put that DC team together? How did it work with Bruce still being at UVA, coaching the Olympic team at the same time? What was that whole experience like in 95 into 96?
Yeah, so Bruce and I had pretty much shaken hands at the NSCAA convention, which happened to be in D.C. in January of 95. But we didn't have an agreement. But so we stayed in pretty close touch. I told the league, you know, there's a couple of players that we want, and everybody got to do this. I said, we want Marco Echeverry, and we want John Harkes. And they said, well, you got to figure out how to get John, because John was playing in England at the time and was successful. And John and I were friends. I would talk to him on the phone from time to time. So I called him one day late in the season, in the spring of 95. I said, would you be interested? You know, would you come here? And for the first time, he said yes. And I remember calling Sunil up, Sunil Gulati, because he was the one responsible for getting the players. And I told him, and he was like, are you kidding me? And I said, no. And he said, that is absolutely huge. You know, it's so important for us to get the national team players, guys like Tony Miola and Tab Ramos and John, because, you know, they were really the symbols of the game in this country. And as important as it was to have the foreign players, really the most important thing was the guys who were the stars of the 94 World Cup team. And that John was a big get, because of all of the field players, he was probably the one who had the most successful career. You know, he had played in the FA Cup final, the League Cup final. He won the Goal of the Year award in England, and things were going well for him. So, you know, Bruce and I talked a lot about that. I remember Bruce telling me, you got to get Jeff Agus. And I said, I knew Jeff because he had been, you know, around the national. He had been on the national team, but he ended up not making the World Cup team. But Bruce had had him for 4 years. And he just said, he's the most competitive player I've ever had. And we got to have him. So we got him. I tried to get Jaime Moreno before the season, but he had been, you know, he had transferred to Middlesbrough on a pretty big, you know, not a huge deal, but it was a highly publicized deal, and they weren't interested in letting him go. So, you know, we had allocations which were from the league with a lot of give and take with the teams. Then we had at least three different drafts. So we had a draft that was for a bunch of foreign players that had been signed. Guys, for instance, Raul Diaz Arce, we got in the draft.
I said, that's a steal.
Yeah, it was a steal. And actually, we got him with the last pick in the first round of that draft. Guys like a lot of the guys that were playing indoor soccer. And then there was a college draft. And then there was actually another draft that we called the supplemental draft later, which ended up producing some very significant players, guys who, for whatever reason, hadn't signed contracts yet and weren't in the first draft, or new foreign players that were being looked at. So we all went to Florida and watched these guys play. Chris Armas came out of that draft to LA. We got a player named Mario Gori. Actually, the best player in that draft we all passed on because he was insisting on $120,000 a year. And we all said, no way. His name was Bruno Jimenez. I'm not going to remember the name. He played under a different name. I think he used his mother's name when he played, but he ended up playing like 9 years in Italy and then 6 years in Mexico and was a top goal scorer in both leagues. And he would have been the best early goal scorer in our league had anybody picked him, but $120,000 was too much money. So we all said no. So it was pretty wild. So the league made these arbitrary decisions. They decided that New York had the highest rated allocations. So New York had Peter Vermes, Tab Ramos, Tony Meola, and Roberto Donadoni. We had John, Marco, Jeff Agus, and a guy named Bertie Suarez, who was a Bolivian, who we didn't want. But they told us, well, you have to take him. If you want Marco, you have to take him. We said, well, we don't want him. He's not going to – he can't play the way we want to play. He said, well, yeah, you got him. So they decided that New York had the top, group of allocations. We had the second. So all the other draft orders were based off your ranking. So we – New York picked last – in the first draft, we picked second to last. And then New York picked first in the college draft. We picked second. It might have been the other way around. But so we picked Eddie Pope in the college draft, which was a pretty good pick. He's only the best center back in the history of our country. But listen, if you really want to laugh, have a laugh, look at our lineup from that first game on April 6, 1996, or even our opening home game. And a significant number of the players in those lineups weren't even on the team like 5 weeks later. You know, we started out 0-4, 1-6, and I think 2-9. And then we, Marco started to play. Marco wasn't fit when the season started. We brought in John Mazur, who Bruce had at UVA, and John was in Germany, hadn't signed a contract at the beginning, but agreed to come in as basically almost like a free agent, if you will. And we signed Tony Sanna. And we also signed a guy named Steve Rommel, who a lot of people forget about. But Steve Rommel came in and scored 13 goals for us the first season as a forward. He was from Rutgers. It did extremely well. And then our season really changed when we kept telling Mark to – we weren't playing Suarez. And we told Sunil, you know, this is embarrassing for him. It's not good for us. So we were able to sell him for a small amount of money back to Bolivia. As a result of that, in the league rules at the time, we were entitled to a replacement allocation, and that became Jaime Moreno. And that really changed everything when he showed up. He was just a different level. I mean, Marco actually started to play at the same time, and you know, so now all of a sudden we had the two best players in the league.
Helpful. That's pretty helpful. Let me rewind it just a little bit for the people at home, Kevin, because we're walking through this season that I think all of us, whether we were alive and watching or not, have become very familiar. But to
I was six.
Let's see. I was born 86. Yeah,
I was 10 years old. Yeah,
yeah. I did not know much about it. I didn't know anything about that first game in San Jose. Of course, you were there. I've heard a lot of interesting stories, and one of the quotes I saw from you about building this and having this first game is that everybody was shooting from the hip. Quote, this thing was literally building an airplane while you were in flight. Give us the most bizarre, weird, oh my God, are we going to pull this off? First game in MLS story you have. Like leading into that game in San Jose, traveling there, hitting the field, the game being played. What was the bizarre moment that you still think about?
Well, there were a few. I can tell them. I'll try to tell them quickly. First, before we left, Mario Gori, who was supposed to be our starting left back, we didn't have clearance from the Argentine Federation for him to play. So they refused to clear him. And so we flew. He flew with us, but he wasn't going to be eligible to play in the game. I went out to look at the stadium the night before the first game, and I saw they had this huge logo in the middle of the field. And I said, I can't remember who it was that I took, probably Bill Sage. I said, you know, I think that's a problem. And he said, what do you mean? I said, you're not allowed to have markings on a field. He goes, oh, it's our first game, you know, they'll let it go. Well, SC Bahamas shows up to inspect the field, and he goes, I'm not reffing the game with that on there. So they ended up having to spend the whole night trying to figure out a way to get it out of the field or cover it up. I don't even remember exactly what they did. But then the other thing was, you know, we felt early on that our uniform was really important. We were trying to build a real tradition. We didn't allow our apparel company to dictate to us. Now, we were fortunate because we were originally supposed to be Nike. They wanted to go in one direction. We wanted to go in another. We just said to Alan, we don't want Nike to do it because we just have different ideas about it. We ended up getting Adidas. And I told Adidas, we want a very traditional look that will stand out and everybody will know who our team is when they see the uniform. And they came up with black, black, black. And our second kit was white, red, white. So we go out for the first game and the league, you know, whoever it was that was like the game producer decides that we're going to wear, I think we wore black, red, white. It wasn't one of our uniforms and we never wore it again, ever in the history of the league in the 25 years since. We've never worn again. But if you look at those pictures from the first game, and it really doesn't look very good. And I remember trying to explain to these people that this is not how you build a tradition. This isn't how you build a culture around your team. But so I do, and I say this with no malice toward anybody because we were all in the same boat. None of us knew what we were doing. It was a complete experiment on the fly. And we were just making it up. But it was fun.
It sounds fun. What are you most proud of, Kevin, from all your years in DC and with the league and building soccer here and continue to do so? What is it about DC, the legacy, the tradition, the club, the championships? What's the one thing that you really take the most pride in?
Well, I'll tell you about a moment. And Charlie will appreciate this. This was before he was on the team, but he'll know what I'm talking about. We had a very good team in, I think it was 2006. We won the Supporters Shield. We were the best. We were clearly the best team in the league. And we played Chicago in a 2-game series in the playoffs, played at their place first and tied 1-1 and came back home and really felt like, actually, it was 2004, it wasn't 2004, I'm sorry, 2006. And we really felt like, you know, we're going to win this game. I mean, we're better than they are, man for man. We're just better. You know, we had Christian Gomez and Jaime, and I think Aleko might have been on that team. And we lost. We just laid an egg, and we lost 4-0. And at the end of the game, no one had left the stands, and our supporters clubs, all you could see on the far side of RFK Stadium was banners and flags. And it was just this amazing display of love for the team, even though we had lost. I mean, we had just, and I thought, wow, you know, we have really done what we were trying to do. We have created a real bond, a real culture that these fans are a big part of. And I always felt that that was critical to the game succeeding in our country. And that's one of the reasons why we took such a traditional approach we wanted, because I believe that around the world, football teams and fans have, they seem to have a different relationship than a lot of other sports have with their teams. You know, a lot of other sports have relationships that are more transactional, and not always. I mean, I'm not saying, I don't want to overly generalize, but you know, when you go to a place like Spain or England or Argentina and you talk to people, and you know, for six or seven generations, they've been supporting the same team. And even if they move, they still support that team. And that's what we were trying to accomplish. So I think the thing that I'm most proud of, probably, and I've got some stuff in this little room that I'm sitting in, that was given to me when I left the club by like the Barra Brava and some of the other fan clubs, the Screaming Eagles. And I'm probably proudest of the fact that the way the fan supporter culture has developed in this league. And I think it started with DC United in many ways. And now it's really league-wide. And that's, to me, is the most exciting thing about what's happened.
Kevin, let's leave you on one last one, though. We've been doing, over the course of the weeks, for every club in MLS, we're doing a Mount Rushmore, the top four players or the most important four players, the most beloved, that go up in history for each club. We're going to do San Jose and Columbus today, but we already did DC United. We didn't have you on at that time, so we want to go back now a little. Not coaches. Bruce Arena got his own celebration. You got mentioned. You got your own space. But for players, for their DC careers, who are the four that have to go down as the, you know, the legends in history?
Well, for 100% for sure, Marco and Jaime. They really are the symbol of DC United. And then I would say Eddie Pope. And then it gets really hard. You know, we have so many good players. Christian Gomez, you know, unsung guys like Richie Williams. Boy, who would I put on the fourth? He wasn't necessarily the best player, but he became a symbol of the club. I would probably put Ben Olsen.
Those are the four we put. We nailed it.
Yes, I feel vindicated.
From the mouth of the god.
It's hard, though. It is hard. And I loved so many of our players. And and Charlie knows what it's like when you have success in D.C. with those fans.
Unbelievable. That's a D.C. bobblehead right there.
One of the most magical nights in the history of our club was Charlie's first game with us. And I'm sure it was a big moment in your life, Charlie. It was absolutely one of the most emotional things I've ever seen in sports. So that's the thing I miss the most about not being in it every day, is the interaction with the supporters and kind of living and dying together. But I'm very proud of where our league is now. And, you know, it can always get better, but we've made so much progress, and we have so many great clubs and clubs that really appreciate the importance of their brand. And there's great players in the league, and it's just, the future is very, very bright.
Well, KP, I can't thank you enough for your contribution to the sport in our country. Can't thank you enough.
I echo that. But I'm also curious what the name of your dog is, Kevin, because I think I hear him barking in the next room.
That's actually my daughter's dog that we're sort of one-sitting. It's a complicated thing, but he's a little dachshund named Huckleberry.
Oh, that's a great name. Thank you so much, Kevin, for everything you've done and will continue to do. Of course, still U.S. Club Soccer CEO now, affecting the game every single day. Kevin Payne, longtime executive here in Major League Soccer, U.S. Soccer, just in the game in the United States. Thank you for joining us, Kevin.
Well, guys, thank you for everything you do. It's really important. And Charlie, it's great to see you again, buddy.
Always. Thank you.
Take care.
All right.
Oh, how sweet it is. Kevin Payne. Names are Mount Rushmore is the correct one. Feels good. Feels good. That Ben Olsen one was a little iffy. We didn't know if whether the coach versus player side should push him out. But
I feel like we're both vindicated, too, in that the first fourth name he brought up potentially was Christian Gomez.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So. I feel like those are votes of confidence from Kevin Payne to both Dave and I. So just
saying, like, I respect your soccer mind is what
exactly,
Kevin Payne said.
Exactly. You are so smart and insightful. Yeah. Thank you so much.
He would probably pick
service.
Cienfuegos for LA Galaxy.
That's in question. We didn't even need.
I'm just curious, who were the other guys on the fringes for your DC Mount Rushmore?
That's a good question.
Boy, now I can't even remember. We were so certain at the end of it.
We had Bobby Boswell, but no, because of his Houston time. Mm-hmm. We talked about Diaz Ricky Arce, Williams, I think.
Yeah. Diaz Arce got in there a little bit. Lassiter got at least a mention.
Was Bill Hamid in there?
Bill Hamid did get a mention as well. Yeah,
I think Tony Sane got a mention.
Yeah.
Agus.
Yep.
Yeah.
Matt, speaking of Agus, let's do the San Jose Earthquakes. You guys ready?
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
From the Frank Yallop observation deck, because there's no doubt the man won two MLS Cups as well as the Supporters Shield in two different stints with San Jose. We are observing faces being carved in the granite. And the first one, I'll start this off, absolutely has to be Chris Wondolowski. Gotta be. All-time MLS leading goal scorer. Almost all of them coming with the Earthquakes. He's just a legend. He's from the area. He represents the club through and through. I expect he will once he retires from playing professionally. But it's Wando. And then I think there's a second, Doyle. Can you tell me who that second is that has to be up there before we really start this debate?
It's got to be Ramiro Corrales, right? Mr. Quake himself, I guess. He was part of the original college draft. So he was an original MLS player in 96. He was the last original MLS player to retire from the league. I think he retired in 2014. Really, really good player. Never best 11 caliber, but like always solid. And, had about a half dozen, maybe 10 caps with the national team as well. Cult hero, but also belongs on that team's Mount Rushmore.
He was the last original MLS player to retire.
So but he was not the last player who played in the original MLS season to retire.
I mean, he played 250 games.
Yeah, he played a lot. The last 96 player to retire was Brad Friedel. But Friedel wasn't an original MLS player because he didn't come until halfway through. Boom. That's your Monday trivia, boys. Let's continue.
By the way, I've been accumulating random, as I do research for these, random trivia, and I'm trying to figure out if we could do like one night a week or even just as a one-off, like mass MLS trivia somehow. I've been playing with my friends. Don't judge me. The name of the game is Jackbox. It's like via your phone, yes. And I don't know if anybody else has played this, but I'm trying to figure out if we can do trivia for like anybody who listens to the show on some given night. So if you know a technology out there, I'm looking into some, let us know. Dave, give me your nominee for the third spot. We got Wando up in stone. And by the way, some Quakes fans just said do four of Wando. Yeah. Or the most important part of this is where does Wando go? Make sure to get him the best light and the most prominent placing. We have Ramiro Corrales, Mr. Quake. Who deserves that third spot?
So I have a few names that go down over the next few spots. This isn't coming from me, coming from every fan that I interacted with and looked at. Ronald Cerritos was the next name on their list.
That's on my list as well.
So I think you have to go with it. El Salvadoran international basically forever. Played for San Jose for 4 years. One of their all-time leading goal scorers. I think he's second on the list, even though he only played there for 4 years. So I think that's an easy one to go down with as
absolutely three. Not. Absolutely not. He was a good player for terrible teams. He had no bearing.
Was he not on the team in 2001 when they won MLS?
But he was lost his job by that point, didn't he? No, all right. So he was on that 2000.
He's leading goals.
So he was on that 2001 team. I retract the really vehement rejection, but okay. I don't think like he was never best 11. He was never best player on the team.
He was an MLS best 11 in his first season.
So
with the
in 97, when they were the worst team in the league.
So far, your first two arguments were never won anything.
They could be the worst
11.
Team. They could be the worst team in the league. He's still best 11. He's still one of the best players in the league.
We're also talking
regardless
about
of how
club.
Bad his team is, which should also give him, I guess, a better chance or shot at making him out Rushmore because he has zero help. Like you said, he's on the worst team, and he's
Eddie Lewis was on that. It was in that group too.
Okay.
So who's your three, Doyle? Who's your third?
It's pretty tough, but I would probably go with Ronnie Eklund. Because if you look at the, you know, other than, well, I mean, the elephant in the room is Landon Donovan, yeah, right? Because the best player for that little run was Landon Donovan.
And arguably D-Row.
And arguably D-Row. D-Row was the other one I was going to make an argument for. But Eklund was awesome. Eklund was arguably the best central midfielder in MLS for four straight years. He was a top three central midfielder in MLS for like four straight years. And it, like, he scored a huge goal in MLS Cup. Like, it, but Cerritos was good, and I shouldn't have jumped on that like I did. But he was not a key part of those great Quakes teams. And like, you have to go from that 2001 to 2005 run.
So when I think of San Jose Earthquakes, so I always remember Ronald Cerritos and mm-hmm. how good he was in the league. And so that's why for me, just as a spectator, I wasn't a huge San Jose Earthquakes or San Jose Clash fan, but one player I do remember when I think of San Jose Earthquakes was Ronald Cerritos, and that's why he'd be on my Mount Rushmore.
You know, I'm going to take the L on this because I'm looking back now, and I just didn't remember Cerritos' career the correct way. He actually came back to the Quakes for that 05 team that also won the Supporter Shield. Okay.
I'll give you okay. Cerritos.
The other thing I'd say about the 01 to 05 teams, to your argument that you've made in the past of how can you be on a Mount Rushmore if you're thought of with other teams, Jeff Agos, Landon Donovan, and D-Row probably can't be on it. Right? So for that span, those are that's your captain, your best player, and maybe your second best player. That probably can't be on the San Jose one.
Can mm-hmm. I just say that I don't think it should be allowed that you are on multiple Mount Rushmores? You that's have to tough. Be on one. If Landon being on LA's automatically disqualifies him, in my opinion, for San Jose, despite the massive role he played. It also disqualifies him because if you're an Earthquakes fan, you don't want to stare at your Mount Rushmore and see Landon Donovan's face standing back at you.
You're right, but they probably do want to see D-Row. And we already put D-Row on Houston. D-Row scored the game-winning goal in MLS Cup, and he was the best player at number 10 on the Supporters Shield winning team in 2005, and he played more games for San Jose than he played for any other team.
He also didn't choose to leave. Like, he didn't have a choice, right. And he didn't play for their rival in Duncan.
Right.
I mean, he did in games, but he didn't do the things that San Jose fans remember Landon for.
Yeah, Landon cannot be there. Just Landon's welcome back to San Jose with the Galaxy. That disqualifies him. And if you haven't seen the footage from that, if you haven't read the stories about that, we have a long form on MLSsoccer.com with all of that. It's incredible. Landon talking about it. Everybody. I mean, he was persona non grata 100%. And in large part, they blamed that move and so much of that on why the team left the city. So Landon's out for me. I know D-Row has this special place in San Jose's history, both as, you know, across the board. But I think, to me at least, you can only be on one Mount Rushmore, and I would put him on Houston's. Mm. That leaves some other names out here. So you've got, you mentioned Agus. Richard Mulroney came up.
Joe Cannon.
Joe Cannon came up in this. John Bush came up in this, but I think Joe Cannon probably gets the edge there. Jeff Agus came up in this. Troy Dyack came up with this.
Can I do the Troy Dyack moment?
Would John Doyle come up in this at all?
So Doyle did come up in this too.
For any fan out there who's not a huge Troy Dyack fan, local guy, fractured his spine, had to have two bones taken off his hip, fused to his spine, then went and played at the time A-League, USL, whatever you want to call it, got cut because he wasn't good enough to play, was told he could never play soccer again, became a player coach in the A-League, worked his way back, tore his MCL, then made it back to Major League Soccer and started and won MLS Cup in 2003 with the Quakes. That's a pretty epic career. Also, when you look at pictures of him from back in the day, he literally looks like La Flama Blanca.
Oh my God. Yeah, who's cooking? Fire,
speaking of that.
Yeah, who's cooking here?
I believe my wife just started.
Is that like the old, oh my God.
Fire in the house?
Who's cooking?
Mute your mic.
Does anyone here know where it is? I think that's the more worrying part.
Yeah, no kidding. Doyle doesn't seem too concerned about a potential fire in his abode.
I was sitting under mine, so you'd know if it was me.
Some other names that came up. Eklund was in here. Shea Salinas.
That's got to be a first. That's a first, huh?
Why are
that's
we not
the first time, huh?
in league in show history?
Yeah.
That, That's because of his Ronald Cerritos take.
Nice.
The place just boom.
That was a trash fire. That was a garbage fire that started down his own home. So, okay, look, I think Ronald Cerritos is there. We have too many other Earthquakes fans saying that he has to be there. And when in doubt, I'm always going to go with what the fans say. Ultimately, it is their Mount Rushmore. It is their monument. Who's the case for the fourth? I mean, I'll throw out Victor Bernardes. I don't think he makes it, but we should at least honor him.
Nope.
Linhart, we should honor. Manny Lagos is a guy who gets forgotten in so many ways. I mean, he would be on sort of the Minnesota all-time Mount Rushmore. Maybe not MLS, certainly not. But the all-time one, he would be there. He scored so many big goals in 01 and 03 in those playoffs, but kind of gets left in the past for whatever reason. Charlie, give me a case for your fourth. Who's it going to be? Who are you going to put up there next to Wando, Corrales, and Cerritos?
It'd be Joe Cannon. He was MLS Goalkeeper of the Year. He's played a ton of games for the club. He when I thought of also San Jose Earthquakes, I think of a great goalkeeper, backstopper who you could depend on, who was consistent. It's Joe Cannon. And he really valued his time at San Jose. I remember talking to him and saying, that's a great city. I love being a part of it. Great locker room. And he was one of the leaders for those dominant San Jose Earthquake teams.
Joe Cannon for the fourth? Anybody agree, disagree?
I double up with Charlie. I didn't even look at the stats. And then when I went and looked, he leads them in shutouts. He's top five in appearances, all those things. But in my mind, he was arguably the best goalkeeper in the league multiple times. And he was what I associate with San Jose when I think about them. And he stuck around the area since he stopped playing. I think he coached their PDL team for a while, stuff like that. So that's what came to my mind. And I agree with Charlie.
Where did we land? Sorry about that, guys.
We're on the fourth one.
What are you thinking?
After your set off the fire alarm on Cerritos, we moved on to fourth.
She somehow lit a grilled cheese sandwich on fire. Somehow. I don't know. We're going to have to get a long explanation for this, but I'm going to maybe ask her to write it all out so I could read it on Thursday's show. Anyway,
Doyle, just so you know, I'd still eat it. So I bet you would.
Joe Cannon, are you in agreement that he's the fourth here?
I mean, Joe's a really good shout. He spent a lot of time there. He won a lot of games there. He won 2001 MLS Cup. But so we have Cerritos, Wando, and Corrales for the three.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would go Dero over Joe. But you know that. So yeah, my vote is Dero over Joe.
I would go Dero too, but I thought we were all taking the same premise. Weeby said,
No, that's just Doyle's rule. So he doesn't have to follow it. Doyle's the one who I felt like week one was like, you can't be on two. You can't be known for another club.
I don't recall.
I'm going to break this this disagreement then. I'm going to go Joe Cannon as well. I would go D-Row if he wasn't on Houston's and if he wasn't the first name on Houston's as well. D-Row can be, you know, we were talking about snack stands or like, you know, the elevator that takes you up to the observation deck or whatever. We can honor D-Row in some way. Or maybe we like put up a simulation of the free kick goal into the top corner. I don't know, whatever it is, D-Row gets honored. But I think Joe Cannon put his mug up on that Mount Rushmore.
One of the things we got was, could the Bash Bros just be combined into one person?
No, and put up absolutely there? Not. Oh, no.
Charlie's the worst person to ask about that. Hey, do you like the big strikers who just win balls late in the game in the air?
Yeah.
Well, there you have it. San Jose, Chris Wondolowski, Ramiro Corrales, Ronald Cerritos, and then finally Joe Cannon, immortalized in their club pantheon. Let's hit the Columbus Crew.
And I do real quick. Last thing. One of the coolest parts about San Jose, about the team, but just the soccer culture, is how many players in this conversation are locals and how like the history of soccer in that area has changed this country. That it's the longest continuous running league is the league that they play at Boxer Stadium, which is the oldest technically soccer specific stadium in the country. So like all of that and going back and looking at it, but I think a lot of us know this. All the guys stay after they play, and most of them are already from there. So it's really cool just to see what San Francisco, what the Bay Area, what Oakland, what San Jose all means to soccer.
By the way, if you want some good Troy Dyack stories, ask Kalen Carr about playing against him as a Cal player. and being terrified. Doyle, we forgot here to do the best year for the Quakes. So give us the best year.
Oh, yeah.
01, 03. Does 12 have any bearing here, despite the lack of an MLS Cup?
I mean, 12 and 5 are you know me, I'm a Shield truther. I thought that team in 2005 was easily the best team in the league, and I still can't believe they didn't do the Shield Cup double. And the fact that they were that good after losing Landon, that was also the first year that they gave Dero the number 10. They put him at the point of the diamond. They let him run the show, and he was best 11 six times in the next 7 years. I think I'm voting for 2005. That team did 2 points per game. There aren't a lot of teams in MLS history that do 2 points per game.
So my vote would be 3. Same. Eddie Robinson, even like Weibel, a veteran, solid, Brian Mullen, all in that group. Weeby, you mentioned Manny Lagos, what he was able to do for that team. They had depth. They brought Dero off the bench in MLS Cup. So I think from top-end talent, you have Landon entering his prime alongside Dero starting to become a legitimate factor in the veteran pieces that you have around them. And obviously Jeff Agus as captain, Pat Onstad.
They play second my team. In the Sapporo Shield.
Yeah.
So
that was also a great Chicago Fire team they beat in MLS Cup too.
Yeah.
So I think my vote would be for 03 as well. And maybe 05 gets in, or 12 even gets in at large. They have great cases for that as well. So let's say 2003 and move on to Columbus Crew. This is a tough one. I think we'll start with the observation deck. Is it Siggy Schmitz? Does anybody else have a shout here? I mean, it's got to be his, right? But if it's his, could he be on Seattle's? That's the question we have to pose to ourselves.
I mean, my gut was that it would, like, Ziggy would be Seattle because he spent so much, you know, so much more time there and, you know, kind of built that franchise on field, where he didn't really do that with Columbus. But at this point, I think Seattle's going to be Schmetzer. So I think that kind of opens the door to give Ziggy to Columbus, doesn't it? And like, unquestionably their best team, their best year, that was Ziggy.
I think I agree with you, although I think, did we put Bruce on for the Galaxy?
We must have.
Oh, did we? We might have.
So we probably put Bruce on twice.
Yeah. Everything blurs together in these times. Yeah,
for sure.
Who knows? I'm trying to establish rules. There are no rules. Society's running amok.
Oh, God.
So it's chaos. So I agree that Ziggy deserves to be on for Columbus. I think we can make an argument later that he also deserves to be on for Seattle and potentially change that and have him on both. But I would agree with what Doyle said, and I would just say, in my memories of the way it went for Columbus, they were like an original, exciting team out the gates. They built the stadium, and then they didn't become relevant to me again until Ziggy's teams became successful, and they didn't really win trophies. So he, I think, took the club into the next era, out of the original MLS one, into the competitive, at the top for a few years. I mean, even the team that won Sporting Shield with Warzea is still a large part of Ziggy's
build. Just so it's clear, the 2004 team did actually win a Supporters Shield. So they did win shields in there before. Well, they did. Right. So they did win.
And they won Open Cup in
2002 before Ziggy. But I think your take on it is largely correct. What he was able to build really quickly, and then hit that high point that no other Crew team has hit.
There are some incredible names in the history of this club. Let's do our best to narrow it down to 4. And I'll start. It's got to be Guillermo Bertoschelotto. I mean, he's a legend in every way in Columbus. He's massive, as they might say there. He's an MLS Cup winner. He's an MVP. So to me, Guillermo Bertoschelotto is unquestionably the first name that goes on my Crew Mount Rushmore. Who's the second name? You could choose from a lot here. There's Brian McBride. There's Frankie Hadick. There's Robin Fraser. There's Stern John. Warzeha was a hell of a player for them. I believe he's still right up there in all-time assists. Chad Marshall. P. Pipa, Higuain, Jeff Cunningham, Eddie Gavin.
Jeff, when I look at this list, you really can't go wrong. McBride had 62 goals, 161 games played. Jeff Cunningham had 64 goals, so he's the top goal scorer in club history. And he was a hell of a player, right, Jeff Cunningham? 203 games played. Higuain leads the club in assists. Warzia did lead the club in assists. He is 61 to Higuain 63. Chad Marshall probably will go next for me, even though he was stellar for Seattle. He had 253 games played for the Crew, massive part of them winning the MLS Cup in 2008. Just one of those center backs that you think of is just an absolute beast. His foundation of his game being played was at Columbus. I'm going to pencil him as number two when it comes to big time players for the Crew and being on Mount Rushmore.
Concur. He was back-to-back defender of the year in 2008-2009 when Columbus won back-to-back supporter shields and MLS Cup. He scored an MLS Cup. He is the best defender this league has ever seen in terms of the career he had in MLS. And most of that career happened with Columbus. He's like D-Row, though, because you can make a damn good argument for him to be on Seattle's Mount Rushmore as well.
Doyle, are you surprised, or any of you actually, surprised, as good as Chad Marshall was in MLS, that it never really took flight with the U.S. Women's National Team?
Hey, Charlie, we've all heard the stories about the fitness tests at National Team Camp with Chad. So, no, not all that surprised.
Sure, fitness tests were difficult, but
he also
as a player being
awesome,
dominant in the air, yeah, could strike a ball, like great in the tackle, communicating, like all the above,
much quicker than people realized, could pass mm-hmm. the ball. No, he was great, and in a different world, you know, he has 80 caps and a much different national team career, but. You know, maybe we'll get some stories about those fitness tests for Bob's national team someday.
I've heard stories about Frankie Hadick's fitness tests where he mm-hmm. partied the entire night and came back and won the fitness test as if it was nothing, like slept in a car.
All right. For instance, 2008, he wins MLS Cup, right? He's chugging beers with fans in the tailgates. 2009 was my first January camp. I'm coming in January camp. Frankie Hadick comes on with his Oakley glasses. Just chugs. What he comes with a gallon of water too, but just chugs coffee. That's it. Chugs coffee. It's just like, dude, I'm here for the fitness test. Like, let's get this started, dude. And I'm like, what are you gonna stretch? One of them, he's like, dude, I'm ready to go. We do the fitness test. I'm like, this guy is gonna bomb it. Like he has sneakers on. Everyone else is like running in cleats. You know, you want to make sure you cut the edges and you save all the time you can on these fitness tests. He just crushes everybody. And then after everyone's gas, he's like, dude, where are we going for lunch, bro? I'm like, this guy's a machine. And was like that every day.
He is a machine. And he did get 80 plus caps for the U.S. It was a little split, which I thought was interesting in the comments on Twitter about whether or not he belongs here. I mean, I think he does. I think it's a no-doubter, Frankie Hadick.
I think it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, absolutely.
No-brainer.
Just saying, that's not how the fans saw it. So I don't know that it's fair for us to say it that way. I was surprised when I looked in the like all-time list that he's not anywhere in terms of like appearances or anything like that. When you look at the way the vote went on Facebook, I think in one of the Crew fan groups, it was McBride and Scalotto first and second. And then Hadick tied basically with Higuain for third/fourth. So he's definitely not those top two. I think it's going to be hard to leave Pipa off this list. So I think Pipa's third because, and Charlie mentioned it, first in assists, third in goals, top five in appearances, was the face of the team for 5 or 6 years, took them to an MLS Cup that they were able to host, which was a huge moment for the team in the city, got them through with some rocky time. More lately as the guiding light for their group. So I think Pipa should be the man that goes down as third. I'm not questioning that Hadick should be on there. I think a lot of what Hadick gets is off the field and post-career his time around Columbus and what he's meant, which I have no problem with.
Yeah,
but I'm just saying you have to mention that.
But Mount Rushmore, my man, deserves, if you say top four faces of the club, Frankie Hinnerk.
But you're talking about a guy
is one of the four.
But you're talking about a guy who won trophies at right back next to a defensive player in the year in Robin Fraser and a defensive player of the year in Chad Marshall next.
Okay, but
and that doesn't take away, maybe, but you're looking at other guys, and I'm not saying he's gonna win over it. Eddie Gavin led parts of the team where Frankie Hajduk was a great right back, but when he was in Columbus, he wasn't the elite Frankie Hajduk that he was earlier in his career. And I don't know that you can say if he wasn't there, the team wouldn't have won.
He scored a goal in MLS Cup, no? I mean,
it's fair.
He did. One of the great overlaps I've ever seen. But a ball from Scalotto. I understand what you're saying, David. I disagree. I think he was consensus best right back in MLS for about the first 5 years he was back in Columbus. Now, he did miss a bunch of time with the national team, and he did miss a bunch of time with injuries every now and again. But all three, he was a starting right back for all three of their Supporters Shield winners. He was a starting right back for their MLS Cup winner. He's stayed in Columbus afterwards. I understand the arguments for other players, but to me, like, defining player in this club's history.
Same. And you got to have the flow on Mount Rushmore. I need to see the flow immortalized in stone. I need to see how the artist does that rendition. I think Brian McBride is the other one. All-time leading goal scorer. He is a legend.
No.
You admit, you know, like he was a Chicago guy, but he doesn't have the time. Goal. Oh, he's second? Oh, Jeff. Yeah.
Jeff. Depends on what competitions you're talking about, I think.
Yeah, I think
MLS goals.
Yeah, MLS goals, okay, it's Jeff cutting Cunningham him. But I think all comps, it might be McBride. Either way, it's Brian McBride, man.
All comps in.
He set the tone for the team.
Yes, I know.
So to me, it's Frankie, and it's Brian McBride, and it's Marshall, and then, of course, it's GBS. And then you're talking about a snub list a mile long, and Frazier, and Warziha, and Higuain, and Cunningham, and Gavin, and Stern John. And this is truly a difficult one among the originals. But to me, that's the four.
I agree. I'm with you, Weeby.
Disagree, but
that's fine. You got
Higuain. I would have taken Pipo over Frankie, but I had McBride in. As my first two, I had Marshall locked in or whatever, and I had GBS locked in as those three. Two of the other names that got mentioned by fans, so I'll throw it out there. I don't know anything about it, but Mike Clark, 7 years on the team, two MLS All-Stars, and someone said the snack bar should be named after Ollie Moreno. So, there's that for you.
Let me actually go a deep cut as well. Brian Mazanov. If Brian Mazanov hadn't, like, he still played 200 games for the Crew, and he was one of the best central midfielders in MLS out the gates. And this was after, like, destroying his knees and his ankles as, like, a 20-year-old, I think, in college. He was one of the best players on that 96 Olympic team. If he hadn't gotten hurt that bad, like, it's not as big an injury what-if as guys like Clint Mathis or John O'Brien, but it's, like, a level down from that. Brian Mazanov awesome for that team for a good long while, and he's still in Columbus as well. I think he's actually head.
Sorry, would you put him over Robert Rozilla?
No,
as like no,
no. But what I'm saying is, if he hadn't gotten hurt, I think he's a guy who would have had like 50, 60 national team caps and multiple World Cup appearances and all that. But U.S. over the years, as you know well know, Charlie, we've had some bad luck with injuries for the U.S. national team over the years.
Can I make an executive decision on the best team of all time in Crew history? And just, it's got to be 2008. Has to be.
Yep.
It's unquestioned.
Yep.
All right, 2008, Columbus Crew.
Can I?
You're part of the,
can I throw a random
the greatest
story
team
in
of
there?
All time bracket. You better hurry because Anders is telling us, producing Anders is starting to tap his watch.
I was studying in England during that MLS Cup, and I had a my local pub, the bartender loved that I was American and liked soccer, and he opened up to stream that MLS Cup final for me from LA at I don't know, or I guess it was like 10-11 p.m. whatever time it was. And he was like, I came in the day before, he's like, mate, MLS Cup tomorrow, like, you coming in? I've got a TV in the back for you. I was like, oh hell yeah, dude. And he was so jacked about the whole thing. He was so pumped about it. So I thank Columbus for that experience. And I thank Dane Richards.
Nice. I love that you got stuck.
And I just watched a guy playing soccer with empty beer cans in the middle of a street in New York City at 1 p.m. on a Monday afternoon. 2020, folks.
401-206-0MLS, extra time at MLSsoccer.com. Please hit us up, text us, email us, help us entertain you, entertain us, please. We'll end here with Felipe from LA, as promised. He says he loves our show. Thanks so much for being around and for still going during this time. It's a fun and welcome distraction. Now the good part. Full respect and appreciation to Charlie Davies, but his call on Beckham being on our galaxy, Mount Rushmore, is plainly wrong. Using his own reasoning about what Beckham has meant to the team and the league, you have to realize what Mauricio Cienfuegos meant to the Galaxy and MLS during his own time. Having such a skilled player from his background in the squad got the Hispanic community fully involved in the team and the league at a time it truly needed real fans. And it's because of players like Cienfuegos and Jorge Campos that you had further years of quality Central American and Mexican players coming to the league and raising its playing level and rising attendance. This league needed the Hispanic audience. What's up?
I was going to say, who had more of a presence in that community, Jorge Campos or Cienfuegos?
I think you're undercutting the El Salvador community in LA. But
I'm not. I'm just saying, who had a bigger
You were supposed to influence. Let me finish this. Felipe in LA has the floor, bro. Come on. Give it a second. All right? I lost my space now.
I know Felipe is like your cousin.
Get out of here. You had
your cousin up there writing this email.
This league says Felipe needed the Hispanic audience to survive its early days. So with the same logic that you wouldn't have Zlatan without Beckham, you wouldn't have Beckham if it wasn't for Cienfuegos helping keep the team relevant. If you don't believe me, come sit in the stands with me and look around at all the Cienfuegos jerseys still being worn. You might see almost as many Beckham jerseys, but considering how long ago Cienfuegos played and how much smaller of an audience the MLS was drawing in those days, it means that much more. If anything, he says it should be Kobe, Cienfuegos, Landon, and Beckham. He says he loves Robbie Keane, but if he's going to be on the mount, maybe Pescadito has to be there too. So big thanks to Felipe in LA for setting Charlie's stage.
I love Felipe, but that's a questionable take right there.
Hey, we all get our time in the sun, all right?
Hey, I love it. And I want to sit with Felipe. I want to see what it's like to sit in that... the LA Riot Squad.
Yeah. We'll get Charlie in there at some point here. All right. We got to get out of here. Anders wants to get us out. He says we're taking up too much of his time. And of course, we're trying to export.
We didn't draw our teams for Thursday. So we'll do it on Twitter later.
All right. Good call. All right. 401-206.
Charlie, why are you so upset?
MLS.
Because I want to know who we're doing.
Okay.
Right,
fine.
Now.
Do it.
Right,
do it.
Give me 1 second. Charlie. Right. But I already tried this with you and all your numbers are always the same.
I got it. I got some more numbers.
Okay. Charlie, give me your first number.
12.
That will be NYCFC. And give me your second number.
Second number is 23.
We don't have 23 teams left to pick from, so there's no one at 23. interesting. New York Red Bulls.
Wow.
Okay, it's a New York show.
Nice. An all New York episode. Wow. All right.
New York Derby.
Hudson River Darb.
Coming on Thursday. All right, folks. Have a great week. Stay safe, stay sane, stay healthy. Hit us up.
Chag Sameach to everyone celebrating the Pesach. I'm trying to get a matzah sponsor in here. So Yehuda, if you work there, hit me up. Let me know. I could save the $4 on a box.
Good ad. Great ad at the end. All right. That's our cue. Have a great week, everybody.